The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 119 for September 10th, 2007. Greetings, folks. You know, John, all that compression we added to keep the vocals more dynamically consistent really adds some crunch to that guitar on the intro. At least it does in my headphones. I'm Dave Hamilton. I'm here with John Braun, and we are hosting the Mac Observer's the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. Hi, John. How are you?
Talk much?
Apparently, I talk too much.
I'm hurt, actually. I got a nasty case of, well, I didn't know what this word meant until very recently, bursitis.
Ah, yes. I've never experienced that.
Really? Oh, okay. Yeah. Basically, you bang your elbow. There's a little sack of fluid that normally cushions things, but if you aggravate it, it gets all red and swollen, and it's just nasty. So
that's not good.
But I'm recovering.
That's what you think.
Yeah. Well, it could get worse. Other than that, things are great.
That's good. So we are here this week back from our review cast last week to answer a bunch of your questions, share some tips that you have sent in over the last 2 weeks. Some stuff about troubleshooting Tiger, some office alternatives, and I'm just buying time while I'm trying to get to our first question because, you know, I got to navigate all around.
Yeah, you're doing pretty good there.
I thought I was. Little vamp, never hurt anybody. And we're going to ask Scott here what he seems to... What's ailing him? Doctor.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Scott calling in from Seoul, Korea.
Wow.
Question I have is about the disk utility on my Core 2 Duo iMac. What's the difference between verified disk permissions and repair disk permissions, or verified disk and repair disk? Do they do the same thing, or do they do different things? And then do I need to do a restart after using either of those? Thanks.
All right. So they do two very different things. In fact,
well, it's oddly worded because you could either interpret it to say, is there a difference between the verify and actual action, which is, when I listened to it at first, I'm like, is that what he's asking? I'm like, no, he can't be asking that. Because
we're going to assume our listeners know the difference between verify and repair. That's right.
Well, hey, you never know. I mean, we may have some real newbies.
That's
some noobs. Hi, noobs.
Okay, so the verify disk actually goes through and checks the structure of the directories. It doesn't go through and scan to see if there's any physical damage with the disk, and that's important to note. And in fact, there's nothing built into the OS X. Into OS X that will do that, as far as to my knowledge. I believe you have to use a third party to do that. The version of FSCK that's built in will not do a surface scan. That is not a feature of it. So
now I think a lot of modern hard drives, because I remember you and I mean, I'm sure you remember this from the bad old days, but you had to manually, I believe a lot of modern hard drives, as long as the damage is not too severe, will actually kind of dynamically deal with this.
To a degree.
Yeah, if something's like horribly wrong, it'll like dynamically say, you know, this part of the disk is really bad. Please don't use it. Though every now and then you can get a marginal spot, in which case I think, as you were suggesting, Dave, you get a third-party utility to, read and write, I guess, every block to just make sure everything's okay.
Yeah, I use Drive. That's something Disk Warrior won't do either. That's something I used Drive Genius from ProSoft for to do a surface scan of the disk. And from what I understand, that's Drive Genius is what they use at the Apple Store to do the exact same thing. So verified disk permissions will not do that. What will it do? It will go through and scan the directory, the catalog structure of your disk, right? If you think about your disk as one part of your disk has all these files and folders and documents and all that stuff out there, and then there's a table of contents of the disk, and the table of contents points to where all these files are. So if the table of contents gets messed up, the file could still be out there, but you can't get to it because there's no path to get there via this table of contents. So repair disk, or verify and then repair disk, checks that table of contents and then goes and fixes it if possible. Now, you can't fix the table of contents if the disk is mounted. So you would, in order to repair disk, you'll notice when you boot, when you run Disk Utility from within Tiger, if you're running it on your local disk, repair disk is not enabled. It is the one of the four options that's not enabled, and you've got to boot from the DVD or the CD. I guess it's only a DVD now to do that. And that actually alludes to something later, but that's what that does. You want to tell them what repair and verify permissions does, John?
Well, that I think we covered in the last step, but that's another part of the disk. So as you were stating, you have the directory, which is a hierarchy, actually, and it wasn't always that way, at least not in the bad old days. I'm reminiscing today, but permissions, it's strictly, and we can dig in a little bit here as to how you should do this, but permissions is who is allowed to do what with a certain directory or a certain file. And, you know, there's owner, group, and world permissions. We'll link to what we talked about in the last episode. But now here's where it gets interesting, because what happens is the OS is actually looking in, it's buried somewhere, it's a receipts folder. Well, one is a disk utility has a set of, so the one recommendation is you should use the latest version of the disk utility as possible.
Yeah.
Because sometimes there are changes in the OS and some of the permissions that may have made sense in earlier versions have been updated or modified. So use the latest version that you can.
Yep.
But then I think the other thing is what it's doing is that it's comparing, now it's only for Apple installed software that this works.
Right.
Not just Apple software, but using the Apple installer. Because what happens is after you install with the Apple installer, what gets stored away somewhere is something called a receipt, which is kind of
a list.
Because that's redundant.
Yeah,
it's a list of all the files that were installed, okay, including the permissions for all of those files. So really what's happening, and we'll link to something in the wonderful Apple support database, but basically it's comparing the ones from when it was installed to what it is now. And if it's different, it's going to change them back. The assumption being that the ones that were set when it was installed are the correct ones, and for whatever reason they got changed. Now, as Dave pointed out, some things aren't available when you boot. For example, repair disk, you can't do off of a boot disk, but permissions, you could either boot off of a CD or...
Should we play the trash man's question before you dive into more permissions here, John?
You know, I think we should, because I think it kind of... Yeah, I was getting ahead of myself.
It sets
here.
The stage. Here we go.
Hey guys, thanks. This is the Trash Man from East Oakland. Thanks for answering my question regarding, putting Tiger on my G4. Changed the hard drive. That's what I did. I moved the DVD drive over. So sometimes you got to spell it out for some people. Anyway, I do have another question, if you don't mind. When I was at the Genius Bar, I don't know why they call it that, but I was at the Genius Bar. One of their geniuses told me that I should no longer repair disk permissions. And he wouldn't give me the reason why. He just sort of kind of waved his hand and went, ooh, it's like some kind of voodoo or something. And I did read that somewhere online. I don't have the reference point, but I did read that online somewhere. Well, if that's the case, why do I still have the option to do that? This kind of is making me wonder, because I'm a fanatic about, maintenance and cocktail and those sort of things. And I'd just love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
All right.
I'd say this genius, you got it. Someone has to take away his propeller beanie.
Wait a minute, though.
He loses genius status. If he in fact stated you should never repair your permissions, I wholeheartedly disagree with that statement.
Now, see, I think perhaps the genius. I think he still deserves to lose his stripes. But I think there was a nugget of truth that he had yet to offer here, and that is. What you were getting into just before we played Trash Man's question. What's that?
No, rightfully so, you cut me off, because it leads into this, which is there are different ways to repair the permissions.
Yeah.
Go on.
So your Tiger DVD is, 10.4.0, 10.4.1, 10.4.2, 10.4.3, 10.4.4, whatever it is, it's frozen in time. Okay. And the receipts that it knows about are frozen in time as well. So if you've got 10.4.10 on your Mac and your DVD is only good up to 10.4.4, well, there might be some changes there. Now, if you can't boot your Mac because there's some permissions issue, it's not a bad idea to repair from the DVD. However, once you've successfully booted your Mac, go ahead and rerun Disk Utility from the live boot drive and update everything to what you've got then. To me, that's the best path to do it. So, you know, doing it from the DVD isn't bad, but it may not be everything you need and it may not entirely be correct. So go ahead and do it that way and then go ahead and do it again once you've successfully booted from your machine. So
right. It could. So I think it was misstated, but yeah, it could potentially make matters worse if you revert to a version of the permissions that were okay with the install CD, but not at the current version you're at, which, you know, changes over time. Now, you know, there was just one thing that caught my attention, then we'll move on here. But in one of the articles, it's an Apple support article, we'll link to it, called Troubleshooting Permission Issues in Mac OS X. Eventually, they get to a point where they talk about, oh, you know, if you got a problem, I believe it has to do with your trash. And they said, you know, you should try this to kind of help empty out your trash if it's stubborn, which could be due to permissions or something else. But they actually suggest that you type sudo space rm space dash fr space.
Now, I'm going to stop you right there.
Directory you want to get rid of.
Yeah, let's say you had stopped right there before you'd done the name of the directory and accidentally pressed enter. Sudo space rm space dash fr. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that wouldn't have done anything. But if you had typed a slash there, it would have potentially wiped out your drive or certainly a good chunk of it. And I think what you were trying to get at, John, was that that's just bad advice to give to people, to type sudo space rm space dash fr for anything. In fact, when I have to do that, and there are times like this where you want to delete the trash, I actually don't type the dash fr, which means recursive for the r. And recursive means go through all the directories. And F means force. Don't stop. Don't pass. Go. Don't collect $200. Just erase it, right? So I'll type sudo space rm space and then type the directory name. Then I'll backspace over and do the dash rf. Because that way I'm sure that I've got everything in place. And heaven forbid I won't type slash and hit return and wipe my drive. So...
yeah, so I would just suggesting that you ever type something where if you don't get the part after the dash FR right, is a recipe for disaster. Now, of course, it's going to ask for your password if you goof up your password.
Yeah, you hope. Unless you've authenticated within the last 5 minutes, in which case it won't require your password.
Or the timer set, but...
yeah.
So we'll link to it, and I'm going to put a warning, you know, never type, because, you know, especially for the noobs out there, if somebody tells you to type that because it'll do something cool... don't believe him.
John writes, "Hi, John and Dave. I'm a longtime listener, first time writing in. At work, I've been able to fix most, if not all, of the Mac issues that arise on a day-to-day basis. But when it comes to my own machine, there is one nagging issue that has been lingering around. When I choose either restart or shutdown from the Apple menu, the machine just sits there as though I didn't click on anything, no dialog box, nothing. I've even created a new account, as the two of you have stated multiple times, to see if it is an issue with the user account, and still... no dialog box stating the computer will either shut down or restart in X amount of time. Right now, the only way for me to shut down my machine is to open a terminal window and run sudo space shutdown space dash H space now. Any help you can give me in this matter would be greatly appreciated." This is an interesting thing. And John and I have talked about a couple of ways. I know you've got you've actually got some research on this. My initial thought was, well, there's got to be something running on a system-wide level. Certainly, creating a new user account, as John and I recommend repeatedly to test with, is one way of ruling out whatever cruft you've got built up in your main user account. With John's issue, of course, that didn't work. That doesn't mean that it's not still the same problem and just a system-wide piece of cruft instead of a user piece of cruft. For that kind of thing, I found there's a utility, and I found it years ago. It still works. It's called Diablotin, and we'll link to it. And it lets you go through and disable all of the startup items, login items, internet plugins, you name it. It lets you disable it. And it'll even let you disable on a system-wide level if you're willing to authenticate to do so. Going through that, even if you're not going to disable anything, it shows you everything that's starting up, both on a user level and on a system-wide level. and might give you an idea. You might see something and say, oh, yeah, you know, I forgot I installed that stupid little thing. And I bet that's what's getting in my way. So it's certainly a handy utility. It, at the very least, it gives you an overview. Even if you don't make a single change, it gives you an overview as to what's running. And you might look at it and say, I don't think it's anything. You might be wrong. You might be right. But at least now you're making a more informed decision. So that's where I would start. And then the only other thing I thought of was, well, maybe something got messed up with the OS. So go ahead and download and install the combined 10.4.10 updater. So those are my two thoughts on it. And I know, John, you said you had done some research on that as well.
Yes, sir. So the first thing I would check, and we suggest this a lot, but it's worth mentioning again, is to run the console application in your application utilities folder. And look in the system.log file, because what it will do, and I verified this on my system, it'll show you that shutdown call. And actually here, I look at mine and it says, shutdown :halt by John Braun, which is my username. And then there's some messages after that showing what happened afterwards. You may see something after the shutdown call, assuming that it gets written to this file, which it should, that's hanging everything up. Like here, I see mostly network-related things. So that's one suggestion. Look in your shutdown.log file. See what's happening after you issue the shutdown. And it may lead to something that you may want to disable or something that's halting the shutdown process. And then looking through the Apple support database, yeah, there's all sorts of good stuff in the console app. I can't believe it sometimes. Sometimes it's scary. But anyways, now there's two things. I did a bit more research of it through Apple support site. So here's one which kind of makes sense, and they talk about this. The title of the article is Restart or Shutdown Delay if AFP, which is Apple File Protocol, I think, volume, is mounted but server may not be contacted. And basically what they're saying is that there's a network volume that's mounted or in a weird state where your computer thinks it's there, but it's not. And I've seen this sometimes too. Where actually I have a machine where I've linked to a network drive, and then maybe I sleep the machine and wake it up, and the state of that connection has changed. And it gets very, very confused. So I think what's happening is it's trying desperately to communicate with that drive, and it's never going to happen. And sometimes AFP, I think, and most network drive connections sometimes get kind of dumb, and they don't realize no one's there. So that's a documented issue. And then the other, now this is only for the classic type of folks here. OS 9 had a folder called Shutdown Items. Now, if you have Classic running, there may be something in that Shutdown Items folder, and this is another documented thing on Apple. There may be things in there that aren't working quite right, and their suggestion, I think, was pretty much, whack everything that's in that Shutdown Items folder, if you even run Classic. I know it's rarer and rarer these days. But that's another documented cause for preventing a shutdown or anything, restart, logout, that sort of thing. So between all of that, I hope.
Certainly gets you headed in the right direction.
I hope we helped.
Before we talk about Mike's narcoleptic Mac, I wanted to tell you all about our first sponsor for this show, which is Barebone Software with BBEdit. BBEdit is a text editor. With BBEdit, you can exercise total control over your text, work your way, and live up to all the standards, supporting just about every language I've ever tried to throw at it. BBEdit auto senses when you've loaded a piece of code, tabs, all and color codes all of your functions and commands. Really, really makes coding simple. And in the latest version, they've added what we call the Dave Hamilton feature, though of course they didn't call it that in the press release. But when you quit BBEdit, it allows you to save, and you can set it to do this automatically, all of your open windows and all of the files you had in them. So if you had 15 different files open in 4 different windows and stuff all over the place, when you relaunch BBEdit, bam, they're all right there, including your FTP browsers and all that stuff. BBEdit's power and interface has no parallel on the PC. There are people who prefer to use the Mac just because they can use BBEdit. Again, this is all available from barebones.com. With that, Mike writes, John and Dave, love the show and subscribed since about this time last year. Have a problem with my Mac. It's a PowerBook G4 with a 1.67 gigahertz processor, if that helps. And Mike, it helps.
Yes,
and I find it'll go to sleep at random, but usually so when I'm chatting with my friends through Adium. Another problem I have with it is that on occasion, when I put it to sleep, or rather when I open it back up, it won't wake up. I've tried moving my finger across the trackpad, I've tried holding down the power button to reset it, I've tried hitting the space bar, and I've tried a few other things. When I've finally tried it all, I do the last resort, take out the battery, wait for the sleep light to go out, which signals the laptop is no longer sleeping and has shut down. When I replace the battery and log in, it tells me the date's December 31st, 1969 at 7 o'clock p.m., and the laptop is my only computer. I need it badly and wish to cure it of its narcolepsy. You know, we started doing some research earlier tonight about this because we thought it was one thing. And
he found the time warp feature that he went back in time. And so what I said is, I think initially your suspicion, Dave, was...
Well, initially I thought it was the internal battery, but...
And then I was going to one-up you and say, you dumb, the PowerBook G4 12-inch, because he didn't specify which one, but... So this is one little mini tangent, but there are very few models of Apple computer that do not have an internal backup battery.
Right.
My PowerBook G4 12-inch is one of them, and there's like three models. So I was going to say, that's the problem. It doesn't have a backup battery. But
and,
then, Dave, you count.
That's right. That led John and I to a discussion about, well, they never made a 1.67 12-inch, so that's impossible. And of course,
you could have called me a dum-dum then.
No, I wasn't going to. I was going to go to Wikipedia first and make sure I was right before I called you a dum-dum. I believe I was ranting about how I knew all things. But, you know, that's semantics. And the Wikipedia article for the PowerBook G4 stumbled onto a phrase called PowerBook narcolepsy. Now, you know, this was like a cosmic fate moment here because that's what I had called this in our show notes. And sure enough, there were a rash of reports concerning sudden and pervasive sleeping of 1.67 gigahertz models, primarily the 15-inch. Symptoms include the PowerBook suddenly entering sleep mode, no matter the battery level if it's plugged in. System logs report, received emergency signal from power management going to sleep now. And the cause of this problem is that the trackpad sensor monitoring the trackpad will sporadically spike to over 100 degrees centigrade, causing the PowerBook to think that it will melt if it does not immediately shut down. And so it shuts down. There are fixes for this. You may be able to convince Apple to do it. Again, this was one of those discussions that magically disappeared from Apple's discussion boards. But Apple may fix this for you. If they won't, or if you don't even want to head down that path, there is a solution that's been called the PowerBook sleeping issue fix. No surprise there. And it involves removing the keks from the extensions, the systems extensions folder that monitor this, and pull those out and problem doesn't happen anymore, which is actually a nice little fix. Of course, if your machine actually heats up to that temperature, it won't shut down either. But it wouldn't happen anyway because your sensor's busted. So, you pick, you know, devil do, devil you don't kind of thing.
I've noticed that trend, though, where, you know, people will raise a huff. Now, sometimes, I don't know, sometimes they're justified. And enough times it's at a point where, Apple, I mean, in general does a very nice job. But every now and then it happens to everybody. I mean, like almost every computer vendor has had a problem with, you know, batteries that go up in flames, not just Apple, because they get sourced in the same place. But, you know, if enough people complain, so this may be one of those issues, maybe they have like a secret, you know, repair program, because there was a known issue that enough people complained about it. So depends on the person you get on the phone. Hopefully you get a good one.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's hear from Uncle Mick. Well, this isn't Uncle Mick. This is just Mick.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Mick Houston from Nashville, Tennessee. Really enjoyed the show. Had a quick question for you. I upgraded recently a MacBook. It's a 2.0 gigahertz Intel Core Duo. And I put in 2 gig of RAM, and I put in a larger hard drive, a 120 gig hard drive. After doing that, and by the way, that went very smoothly, I noticed on when you go to about this Mac, it does not show the startup drive anymore on my particular MacBook. When I go to my wife's MacBook or my iMac, I'm able to see that information. So everything seems to be working fine, but I cannot get to that information that shows what the startup disk is when I pull up about this Mac. I don't know why it's not doing that. I don't know if it's even anything to be concerned about, but I thought I'd ask you that. And then also, I haven't seen necessarily a very easy to see increase in speed from the 2 gig of RAM versus the 1 gig I had in the computer. Wondering what I could do to maybe test that. To give you a example, the iMac that I have is a 1.83 gigahertz Intel Core Duo, and it opens up Quicksilver, for instance, during the startup process much faster than my 2 gigahertz MacBook with 2 gig of RAM. The iMac has 1.5 gig of RAM in it. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that, and of course you can reach me.
All right. So as I was listening to this, I kind of thought about the process that Mick went through here. Mick, you probably, you know, you got the RAM and the hard drive at the same time. So you probably unplugged it from the, you shut down the computer, of course, unplugged it from power, removed the battery and set to work. You put the RAM in first or last and then put the hard drive in or vice versa. As John and I discussed, there are most Apple laptops that have an internal battery. I'm not sure if it's a battery or just a capacitor that holds the charge, but it's one or the other. And it holds enough of a charge to keep the clock going and all of that for a limited period of time. Of course, if you've got the battery out long enough to swap the hard drive, that limited period of time is up. And so the computer loses all of its settings. One of the settings that's stored in what's called this PRAM is the startup disk. So your computer has lost the setting for its startup disk. Now, when your Mac starts up, the first thing it does is it looks at this setting and says, what startup disk do you want? If there's nothing there, then it starts looking, okay, what disks do I have? And the first one that it finds, basically, it starts from. And so it starts from your hard drive every time, regardless of whether or not you've got this setting in there. My guess is if you went to System Preferences, startup disk, and selected your hard drive, you would then find that it was there in your About This Mac from the Apple menu. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, first of all, the difference between 1.5 and 2 gigs of RAM at system startup is negligible. Your Mac's probably going to use somewhere between, I'm going to say, 600 megs and a gig of RAM to get itself fully started up and happy. Now, if you have less than that, it's going to page out to swap a little bit. But if you've got, a minimum a gig of RAM, it's going to start up just fine without having to flood a whole lot out to swap.
I think we're talking lowest common denominator here, which I think you're going to.
Yep. Yeah. You're right. No. Yeah. So we got to start looking at what else is different. And I would even venture to say that if your iMac had a gig of RAM and your MacBook 2 gigs, the iMac would still start up faster. Why? Because of the hard drive. I don't care how fast of a drive you put in a laptop. I've never seen a laptop drive outperform a desktop drive, a full height 3.5-inch drive, or a half height 3.5, which has become the full height. But again, another tangent. I put the 7200 RPM drive in my MacBook Pro. Now, again, I've got the Core Duo, not the Core 2 Duo, MacBook Pro with 2 gigs of RAM, and it's piggishly slow as I'm swapping between apps. So, when am I going to see, or when is Mick going to see the benefit of having 2 gigs of RAM? Well, that's just it. If you've got a bunch of apps open and you need to switch from one to the other, more often than not, with your 2 gigs of RAM, you're not going to have to page out to swap. And at that point, yeah, you will notice that things are a lot snappier. When I was doing a lot of Windows consulting, people would complain because we'd, double their RAM or something. And they would say, gosh, my system now, it takes longer to boot. And my answer was, well, yeah, you've got more RAM. So it's going to read in more than it would normally. And that's kind of how Windows would work. And I'm not sure, whether or not that's how the OS X works, the boot process is not when you're going to notice the difference of your RAM, unless you had so little RAM that it was just, bogging you down. But there you go. Yeah. So,
yeah, the lowdown is your hard drive's a dog.
Because
what I was saying is just when you're looking at relative speed of things, the processors are pretty fast. And RAM, unless, as you said, you're severely constrained, is pretty fast, but hard drive speeds are orders of magnitude below all of that.
Yeah.
As far as the data throughput and all that. And I'll differ with you, Dave, because if you're willing to pay, you can get a laptop drive that's as fast, if not faster, than a desktop drive. But you will pay.
I'm going to interrupt you here. I would be happy to pay, and I'd be happy to talk about it here on the show if somebody could show me a laptop drive that actually performed equal to or better than an average desktop drive. I just haven't seen it. I've been living on laptops since 1998, so 9 years I've been using a laptop as my main machine. And the biggest complaint I have is that the drives are piggishly slow. And I don't, the specs have not mattered to me in the least. I don't see any difference between the 5400 and the 72. They're all just pig slow. And I would love to be proven wrong on this.
It sounds like a geek, maybe a geek to geek challenge.
There you go.
I don't know. But yeah, hey. If you folks have anything to say about it,
yep.
All I'm saying is that you may have to pay dearly to get a laptop drive. That
I'd like to know what that number is.
Okay.
Show me a number, and I might pay it. Of course, I need to update my MacBook Pro anyway. But but that's that. And if I guess if Lisa listens to this show before Thursday, she'll know that I ordered her an iPhone last week. But I did.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, I needed to have one.
The new improved price.
At the new improved refurb price, so I only paid $350.
You got the refurb, right.
Of course, why not?
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, heck, why not?
Yeah.
And that was Steve to give back the, give people back the money.
Yeah, it was the right PR move. I agree. Yeah.
Did you see the joke article? I think BB Spot, which is a humor site, was saying that anybody who bought a Lisa is entitled to a $7,000 Apple Store credit. Because they got
that's
rooked
awesome.
Bad, man.
Yeah.
Lisa owners, I mean, that was like a $10,000 computer, even back in money of that day. Oh, my gosh.
That's awesome.
It was a good joke piece. All right, what's
I had to buy one. I needed one in the camp here. I need to have one to work with, but as many of you have read, I mean, I did that editorial over at iPod Observer last week.
About hating the iPhone?
I don't hate the iPhone. I thought you said you hated it. No, somebody else said I hated it, and I answered his question. But yeah, it just doesn't it doesn't do enough for me. It's not flexible enough for the life I need to lead here. But I needed to have one in the camp, and Lisa's razor burned out, so I ordered her one. She thinks a new razor is coming. The iPhone is the replacement, so...
That's
surprise. You know, there you go. All right. We talked, and actually, the Trash Man was the one who brought it up. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how all of his troubles upgrading from or installing Panther and then upgrading with the Tiger upgrade DVD. And the first thing that John and I did, and we got wrong, so this was the one thing that we didn't know, was that there actually was a Tiger upgrade only DVD. Which is interesting. Apparently there were machines that shipped with Panther and then came with this upgrade DVD that you would plug in and it would bounce you up to Tiger, but only if you had Panther pre-installed. So what he was doing there was a sound endeavor. The problem was, we'll let Dale kind of talk us through this a little bit here, because we talked about all the different ways of connecting or getting the Tiger DVD to run in his Yikes G4, which did not have a DVD drive. We, of course, suggested take the drive out of the G5, put it in the G4, boom, you're done.
There were gorgeous. Get a random drive, another drive.
That's right. That's right.
That was what I tossed out.
Yeah, although you'd need that third-party utility that doesn't come to mind. And I know Michael knows exactly what it is, and Michael Johnston has already put it in the AAC feed right here. Michael Johnston of iPhone Alley, that is. But that is the utility that lets you boot from a non-Apple DVD drive. So... and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head.
Oh, yes. Someone wrote in and I put it in the show notes, actually.
Yep.
Someone wrote in also saying, psst, by the way.
Yeah. So it's there again in the show notes. John will put it in the stuff mentioned or stuff almost mentioned section. And then we'll let Dale talk about this, but there's yet another issue.
Hi, this is Tim from the High Potency Music Podcast. About the issue about putting Tiger onto a machine that doesn't have a DVD drive and not wanting to go through getting some of the DVD back to get CDs. I seem to recall at one point I put my G5 into Target disk mode and connected it to my MacBook Pro, and there was a disk in the DVD drive, and that showed up as well. Both hard drives in the G5 as well as the CD drive showed up. So if you put the install disk in the G5, put it in a Target disk mode, connected via FireWire to the G4 with no DVD drive, you might just be able to boot it up that way across using the FireWire to the CD or DVD drive in the G5. I'm not at home, so I can't test this right now, but I wanted to call it in so you guys could check it out or whatever. And talk to you later. Bye.
All right, so that was Tim, sorry. And listener Dale actually confirmed what Tim said, so I had trouble reading my own notes here.
Yeah, I got a response to that, though.
Yes, you do.
Would you like it?
I would love it, and so would they.
Okay.
Well, actually, what Tim says...
No, their advice was totally valid for every G4 Mac, except... Yikes. If we are to trust, and this rings true to me, I sort of remember this, our friends at Low End Mac have a wonderful database of all the little nuances of all the older Macs here. And unfortunately, it seems the G4, yikes, had a problem, yikes, in that it couldn't boot off of a FireWire drive. Every G4 Mac after that. So in that specific case, Target Disk Mode would not have worked.
Not either way.
But for all subsequent, huh?
Not either way. You can't do it. The G4 itself won't boot into Target Disk Mode, and it won't connect to anything in Target Disk Mode. Nor will it connect, or nor will it boot from any FireWire device at all. That's right.
Well, just this one.
Just the yikes. That's right.
Just the yikes. All past that, yeah. So the models after that could do that. So, you know, that's how it goes. But yeah, Low End Mac, love the site. And it brings out these little oddities, so which kind of disappointed me because I thought, well, you and I thought at first, well, you know, I think we just kind of subconsciously knew this, and we just because we kind of skipped over. No, we had as we call it a
Are they coming to get you, John?
No, that's the I'm down the street from both the fire and police department, which is
sure.
Bad.
Yeah.
That's the bad part.
Folks, when John disappears off the podcast, I'll wrap things up for us, but he may not make it back next week. We're just going to say that. I don't know.
But
why.
You and I had what I think we refer to technically as a brain fart.
Thanks.
Well, come on.
There you go. Yeah.
Up here comes Rescue One. Okay. I think that was Engine One going by. Rescue One's coming. Hold on.
You need to soundproof your studio like I did. Of course, I say that, and the soundproofing's not in the window. The window is wide open here.
I don't have a studio.
Don't tell them.
Sorry, I'm in TMO Towers.
TMO Towers East number 2. So Lester also suggested a good alternative. Again, wouldn't work with the yikes, but would work with any other Mac. And if you don't have a spare DVD drive, or you don't want to move it from one machine to the other, and you don't have a spare hard drive to sacrifice, if you have an iPod, reformat the iPod, put it in enabled FireWire disk mode, and then dump the installer onto the iPod. You need to do the same thing that we talked about with any other hard drive. You need to make it so that it's bootable and all of that stuff. Restore the DVD to the iPod, and then you could boot from the iPod. Now, you want to talk about slow hard drives. Man, the iPod takes the cake, but it would work. And then, of course, you just, when you're done, restore the iPod to the way that it was, and you're good to go. So that's...
Well, that hard drive, I think it wasn't really speed, because I think the main thing is it was for storage, and they would cache a boatload of data in RAM, so you didn't really need a blazing hard drive. I mean, noticed when it was, you would hear the hard drive spin up, and that's when it was loading the RAM cache after that. But get away with as cheap slow a part as you can, right?
They don't know. iPod didn't need a fast hard drive. I mean, you're talking about streaming MP3s that, 128K? Yeah,
yep.
I think it's plenty fast for that. Our second sponsor for this show is Audible. audible.com/MacGeekGab is the link. Audible will allow you to browse their catalog of over 35,000 titles of audiobooks. You can listen to these books on pretty much anything that you can listen to this podcast on. Your computer, your iPod, your CD, burn it to a CD, your PC or your Mac. You could even listen on your Trio, and even on your iPhone. By visiting audible.com/MacGeekGab, you get a 14-day free trial of Audible Listener Gold and one free download to check out the service. All kinds of books available. Some geek-oriented books for you folks might be, and us, I don't mean you as separate from us, I mean all of us. I Was, How I Invented the Personal Computer and Had Fun Along the Way. Stephen Levy's The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Icon, Steve Jobs, the greatest second act in the history of business, and Alan Deutschman's The Second Coming of Steve Jobs. Again, this is all available from audible.com/MacGeekGab, and that will allow you to get the one free download and the 14-day free trial of Audible Listener Gold. With that, Gary actually had a very, very interesting thing come in. And I'm going to read this, and then John, I know you're itching to talk about this, which is why I wanted to pull this. So
I'm itching in general, but
thanks. You know, you say that stuff right before I have to read like four paragraphs from somebody here. I appreciate what you do for me, John. Gary writes, my 20-inch iMac suffered a power supply failure, and I arranged to take it to a local Apple store and have it repaired. Upon dropping it off, the genius checked to see if the machine powered up, which it didn't, printed the diagnostic and repair auth form, and asked me for the user or administrator password. I told him I didn't remember it, which was a lie. Now, as my wife can attest, I have always used difficult-to-remember and even more difficult-to-guess 25 to 32-character passwords on my user accounts. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, Gary, but we're going to move on with this. Administrator accounts, forget it. I have those stored in digital wallets on other computers because they are so random. I thought that since it was a hardware problem, they would just replace the power supply and see if the computer would boot. Once the service tech would get to the user login screen, they could shut the machine down. At most, they could use a boot disk if they needed to perform diagnostics. Well, when I picked the iMac up and took it home, it booted straight to the user account. No logon screen, no password. Everything was there for the service tech or anyone else to see while it was being serviced. Here's my question. How did they so trivially bypass my password? Is there a password cracking or other utility floating around the back of the Apple store? As someone who's concerned with security, this makes me think that all the time I spent typing those long passwords was worthless if someone can just come along and bypass my password. I'm concerned because I need to take it back because the lower fan is making a lot of noise. Any other computer, I'd replace it myself, but the iMac can be a tough nut to crack regardless of how hard the part is to find or purchase. All right. John, I'm going to let you go on this password thing here.
All right. Well, the first thing, I think Gary has some trust issues.
No, I'm sorry.
This isn't. No. No, it's a valid concern, you know, whenever your data gets out of your control here. But here's how you get around this. So as a matter of fact, if you have an install CD,
there it is.
There's a little ditty on it where if you boot from an install CD and you eventually get to the point where you're ready to install the OS, but you don't install it, and you go to the, I believe it's the installer menu.
Actually, in future, it used to be the installer menu. Now there's a new utilities menu, but the command is the same, John.
But the command is the same, and it's called reset password.
Ding, 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 ding.
And you know what it does? Yes. So, as to your question, do they have a magic disk? Yes, we all do.
Yeah.
Now, so that's the first thing. So, yes, anybody who has normally, unless you've done something, which I'm going to tell you about in a moment, normally anybody can boot from the install CD and make this choice. And, you know, I mean, it's. I guess I'm okay with it because if somebody has physical access to your machine, it's pretty much game over.
Yeah, they could take the drive out, mount it in another machine, uncheck the use permissions on this drive, and look at everything.
Unless, which go. I think at the end of his email, he suggests one way to get around this, which is if you encrypt. But anyway, so say you don't, say you would like to make your computer a little less prone to the booting and resetting of password thing by Apple service people or other people, well, you know, there's a handy little utility, and that's why this is a kind of back and forth, called Open Firmware Password. This is a utility you can download from Apple, and it does... Well, open firmware is what is inside of all modern Macs here, and it's, you know, what helps the machine start up and all that. But what this utility does, among other things, is when you run it, it prevents you from booting from any external device. So if you would like to, and you know you could verify this, if you run this utility and you enable this feature, if you put in a CD, you have an external drive, it doesn't matter. Even if you hold down C, it ignores it, and it boots off of the last selected drive, which the assumption is only an administrator can select the bootable drive. So this is a way to prevent people from casually booting an external drive and messing with your machine.
All right.
Now, of course, there's a way around that.
All right. Go ahead.
Well, you know, that setting is stored in Open Firmware, which, as we were talking about in the past, I read up a little bit on this. As we talked about in the past, you usually have some sort of backup battery. Well, as far as I can tell, this setting for Open Firmware is stored in the parameter RAM. So if you're really, really, really determined, you could disconnect the backup battery to the machine that you would like to compromise, and eventually this Open Firmware password deal will go away, and then you can boot from an external device.
All right. Now I got a couple things to say here. Do you have one more thing to add? I'll let you go.
Oh, no. That I think pretty much covers it, but it's a kind of cat and mouse there as far as, you know, how you prevent it. But yes, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
I got something to say. All right. First of all, the open firmware thing is great for you folks that haven't yet updated to Intel Max, but as listeners have been keen to point out in the past, all of our Intel Macs don't have open firmware. They use what they call EFI, and EFI, I believe, is inaccessible to the user. You can't, you know, with open firmware, you can boot in, like you said, with Command Option OF. I don't believe there's any way to get to EFI, and I don't think EFI has any of these additional parameters available. No boot password, no none of that. So if you're on an Intel Mac, this isn't even an option for you. So that's one thing to bear in mind. Number two, Gary said that he used 24 to 32 character passwords. Now, I'm a Unix guy from way back, and I may be showing my computing age here, but I believe Mac OS X is consistent with all the other Unixes or Unices. Maybe that's a geek challenge. How do we pronounce multiple? I think it's Unixes, right?
Unices?
Is it Unices? I don't know.
Unixes.
I think it's Unix's. I think it's the latter. Yeah. I don't think Mac OS X differs from all the other flavors of Unix in this particular point, and that is the maximum character length of a password is 8. That's it. 8 character passwords. So your 24 to 32 character passwords are, you know, what, 16 to 24 characters too long. The machine is completely ignoring everything starting with character 9. You could type the first 8 characters of your password and then all zeros or nothing at all, and it would take it. And I'm curious to try that out. I've always assumed that password length was 8 characters because Mac OS X is based on Unix, and that's just, you know, we all make these assumptions, right, without even thinking about why we're making them. So I've never set longer than an 8-character password, but I don't think it would matter. So so there you have it. And now, yeah.
You know, though I'm reading up here, Dave, I found an article that suggests here, and I'll read the line here, it says, Intel-based Macintosh computers can be protected by firmware passwords as well. The firmware in an Intel-based computer uses EFI.
Right.
Open firmware is used in PowerPC, but looking at this follow-up article, it appears to me that you can enable this functionality with both platforms, though it may be a different program.
Sure. Huh, I'd love to know how to do it.
That, it's not entirely accurate, but yeah, I'll read up a bit more, but it sounds like with Intel you can do this as well, and it has the same effects, where mostly it's you know, preventing target disk mode and booting from a CD and things like that. So let me do a bit more digging, but I think it may be a different application.
Yeah, that would be good to know.
That does this.
Huh. All right, well, that's enough for me. I don't know about you, John, but
I've had enough.
I think we've gone through enough. There's actually one more thing. You know, John and I are going to Portable Media Expo at the end of September here.
New.
You got it. Yeah, it's right. It's the Didn't New Media and Podcast Expo, or Podcast and New Media Expo. Yeah.
Actually, I think, yeah, they're getting rid of the podcast part, I guess.
No, it's Podcast and New Media Expo. I've got it right in front of me here. Yeah.
Got it.
And the reason I have it right in front of me is because TMO is proud to be a media sponsor not only of the Podcast and New Media Expo, but also this would be on September 28th, which is Friday night at 7:30 p.m. at the Ontario Convention Center, is the Culture Catch Salon. And that's a really fancy name for a kickin' party, is what it is. So there's going to be a whole ton of entertainment at this party. It's open to all 2,500 plus attendees of the expo and their guests. It's totally free, assuming you've paid for your admission to the expo. But all sorts of entertainment, emceed by Hayden Black from Goodnight Burbank, live music from the all-girl trio Von Iva, DJ David Starfire, aerial arts, that's acrobatics to you and me, John, from Drea Weber, and Brazilian belly dancers. In addition to that, $5,000 worth of prizes from co-sponsors Gibson, Griffin Tech, JBL, Monster Cable, Shure, Ultimate Ears. And then there's also additional sponsors who have helped fund this event. IOTA, Promonet, Kiptronic, Podkive, and of course, TMO is the media sponsor. So if you're going to be there at PME, go check this thing out. Friday night is typically this is it. This is what's going on. If you went to the PME site to look what was going on, look and find out what was going on Friday night, this is what you'd find. So definitely come in and check it out. John.
I may check it out.
You better.
You may have something.
So let's talk about this.
Friday. Oh, no, it's... I wish you had it the last day. Everybody's like, oh, that's going to be... I'm going to hate the flight back. I'm dreading.
I'm going to be late to the party only because I already committed to have dinner with the folks that have provided you with the fast pipe to get this show, and that is Cashfly. So that's where you always download the Mac Geek Gab from. The podcast marketplace this month has the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebones Software, one free download from Audible, and PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac. The Backbeat Media Podcast Network is where you go to sponsor this show. And, John, I think that's it. I think we've had it.
Well, did we talk about 206-666?
Thank you very much.
I guess we did, or 4335.
206-666-GEEK or 206-666-4335. Those are both the same phone number, and they are the number to call if you want to send in an audio comment. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the other way, and of course, MacGeekGab on Skype is the third and, I believe, final way of going about and doing this. So, and John,
this is America, or even if you're not in America, you should vote.
Yeah, go to Podcast Alley.
iTunes, we love the latest iTunes comments. Good stuff. Thank you so much. Don't leave a nasty comment, because you know what's going to happen if you leave a nasty comment.
You might get caught.
Made up.